Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to The World Transformed 2 on Fast Forward Radio. The World Transformed 2 is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find information about this series at speculist.com and worldtransformed.com. This series explores 10 major transformations that will forever change our world and our lives. Some of these transformations are likely to be upon us soon. Others are already underway. Throughout this series, we're talking with futurists, scientists, philosophers, artists, pundits, and other thinkers to gain a better understanding of what we need to do to prepare ourselves for these changes and for life in a world transformed. In The World Transformed 2, we've explored how we think, life extension, nanotechnology, human enhancement, artificial general intelligence, virtual worlds, post-scarcity, existential risks, and the technological singularity. Tonight, we conclude the series with Part 10, Human Destiny Transformed. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. We have come to the last show. It's incredible. It's been a great, great series.
Well, it's been a short summer, hasn't it? I can't believe how quickly 10 weeks goes by. It seems like we just queued it up, and now here we are. Here we are doing the final show. I'll say at the end, though, I think I'm just about ready to not have to do The World Transformed for a few weeks.
It's sort of like the David Letterman and things. You know, there's a season during when they have the presidential candidates come on and things like that, one right after another, right before the elections, and it's all so serious. And, you know, they're finally, you get the feeling that they're ready to bring Cher on or something.
Exactly.
It's time for Britney Spears or Paris Hilton, because this has been way too serious too long. But actually, this has been a brain workout, and I've been glad to be a part of it. It's been awesome.
Yeah, it's been tremendously fun, and we've saved the best for last, because we're going to conclude the series by talking about one of the ultimate questions in life. This week I don't have an elaborate introduction for our topic the way I've been doing with each of the previous topics in the series, because really our topic tonight is just a question, and that it's a question that people have been asking for a very long time. Now, William Shakespeare put it very eloquently when he wrote, "We know what we are, but not what we may be." And much more recently, one of my favorite recording artist, Tom Waits, put his own stamp on the question when he wrote, "And I want to know the same thing everyone wants to know, how's it going to end?" So tonight we'll be talking about how it's going to end with four very special guests, beginning with a panel discussion featuring John Smart, Vanessa Miamis, and Robin Hanson. And then in a segment coming up a little bit later this evening, we'll present our interview with Kevin Kelly. So, Stephen, let's bring out our panel.
Absolutely. John Smart is an evolutionary development systems theorist who studies science and technological culture with an emphasis on accelerating change, computational autonomy, and technology foresight. He is a professor and program champion for the MS program in emerging technologies at the University of Advancing Technology in Phoenix, Arizona. He also directs the Acceleration Studies Foundation, a nonprofit technology and social foresight research organization headquartered in Mountain View, California. John is an affiliate of the ECCO Research Group at VUB and a co-founder of the Evo Devo Universe Research Community, an international community of scholars exploring evolutionary and developmental processes of change at the universal and subsystem scales. His personal website on acceleration technological change is accelerationwatch.com. Welcome, John.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephen. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, next I'd like to welcome Vanessa Miamis. She's a futurist and writer exploring how social technologies are transforming communication, collaboration, and commerce in a network society. Vanessa is the executive director for ContactCon, a participatory festival that highlights opportunities for new forms of peer-to-peer culture, governance, and collective action. Her recent projects include The Future of Facebook, a six-part video series and Open Foresight, a methodology for engaging experts and the public to create collaborative visions of the future together. She recently completed a master's in media studies at the New School for Social Research, and she authors a really neat blog called Emergent by Design. Vanessa, great to have you with us this evening.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, and if you don't mind my announcing this to the whole world, this show is actually being broadcast on your birthday, so a very happy birthday to you.
Thank you very much. It's the big 3-0.
Wow.
The big 3-0. Well, congratulations on that landmark, and I wanted to point out that it's your birthday in particular because this is also my birthday.
Congratulations.
Well, happy birthday.
Hey.
So happy birthday to both of us. I must admit to being a little bit past the big 3-0. I mean, you're short of another big age that ends in O, but let's move quickly on to the next guest, I think.
Let's do so. Robin Hanson is an associate professor of economics at George Mason University, a research associate at the Future of Humanity Institute of Oxford University, and chief scientist at Consensus Point. Robin is a pioneer in the field of prediction markets. He was the first to write in detail about people creating and subsidizing markets in order to gain better estimates on future outcomes. He has diverse research interests with papers on spatial product competition, group insurance, voter information incentives, incentives to fake expertise, Bayesian classification, agreeing to disagree, self-deception in disagreement, the origin of life, the survival of humanity, very long-term economic growth, growth given machine intelligence, and interstellar colonization, to name just a few. Welcome, Robin. Glad to have you as well.
Thanks. My birthday was Sunday.
Oh, well, happy birthday to you as well, Robin.
And I'm also a little older than 30. And I have a blog called Overcoming Bias, where readers may like.
Overcoming Bias, and we do have that link at worldtransform.com. In fact, I should point out that Stephen's not kidding when he says to name just a few. I took that list of subjects, Robin, that you've written about, and I had to pare it down by about a third, actually, I think, to make it fit in our time period here. Just a wide range of things that you've written on, and we're looking for you to bring all of that to bear in telling us how the future of humanity is going to roll out.
All
here.
In 40 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Nice alliteration in there, too, Phil. I appreciate the way you brought it.
I do what I can, yeah. So the clock is ticking. So let me just set the stage for this. This is what we've been doing in The World Transformed. As John mentioned, we had an earlier series, The World Transformed, in which we laid out what all these major transformations are and defined them. And for this particular one, talking about human destiny, was actually a two-part show that we did with John, talking about where things might end up. And we're not trying to recreate those shows in this series. This time out, we're coming at it from a slightly different angle. We're still talking about what these transformations are and what they mean, but it's less about defining what they are and more about talking about how they will impact our lives and talking about what significance they might have for us as individuals and as a society. So with that in mind, Stephen, you want to get the ball rolling?
Absolutely. I get to ask really the ultimate question. Is the ultimate fate of humanity something that people need to be doing something about now? If so, what should we be doing? So, let me just put it this way. I mean, you could say that, sufficient unto the day are the problems thereof. So why should we work on these things? Why should we care about things that are so far into the future? I start with you.
I think, Stephen, your voice dropped right at the critical moment when you said whose name you were putting the question.
Okay. Okay, sorry about that. John, let's start with you.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. Well, if you take a really long-range perspective on human evolution, you can say that the forebrain, which is very well developed in human beings, far more even than other primates, if you read Goldberg's book, The New Executive Brain, it's a wonderful book on just how different we are even than our closest primate cousins, we've recently evolved for looking at the future. And as Jeff Hawkins says in On Intelligence, almost everything about the way human neural structures work seem to be biased to be constantly predicting. So I think the reason we care about these things is because we're built to care about them. It's very adaptive to do that. And now we've you know, tiny little human beings thinking about the birth and death of the universe and able to actually have, you know, reasonable, concise models about that and chase the evidence down for one versus another kind of a future. And, you know, looking at things like dark energy, which we've uncovered just since 98, and what are the implications of these long-term models of change that we have? So I think that's the basic reason we should be concerned about it, is because we're built to be concerned about it. And if we look a little more closely, we discover it's highly adaptive for us to have these big picture models. And, you know, there's a lot of trends, a lot of destabilization that occurs with accelerating change. You know, you had Martin Ford on talking about the destabilizing effects of automation in his book, his recent book about that. You know, I think we have plenty of issues with regard to risks, existential risks. You recently had some a section on that, and I know that Robin's done quite a bit of work on that topic. And I would say, to say a very, very brief summary, I would say the closer humanity gets to post-biological status, the more it looks like we can rapidly become immune from all sorts of existential risks, risks that are highly lethal to us today as biological beings. But we've got all these non-biological extensions to us, and they seem incredibly good at protecting us from a lot of the risks that face us today. So if we can figure out where we're going and how to get there better and faster, as long as we're not creating more downsides and externalities on the way, I think there's a tremendous upside to being concerned about these things.
Absolutely. Okay. Robin, let me throw the same question to you. Is the ultimate fate of humanity something we need to be thinking about or doing something about today?
Well, John's right that we have an urge to think about it and talk about it. I actually think most of the urge we have to think and talk about the distant future is not very functional in terms of dealing with the future. It's more about having a symbolic palette in which to tell stories indirectly about concerns we have today, the usual story about science fiction as well. But the future really exists, and if we could set aside all these symbolic desires to paint current battles in the future, there are real issues. Obviously, the biggest reason to think a lot about the distant future is to be motivated to make it exist. So that would be the existential risk concern. If you think the future is this little unimportant thing, then you might not bother much to protect it or ensure it exists. And then, of course, beyond that, you might become motivated to continue on to exist in the future. You might want to try to live long, perhaps be a cryonic customer, or do something else that you could ensure that you could be there. Or even setting that aside, you might want to try to think about how your descendants or clan or whatever could thrive in the future. So back in the past, you know, I don't know, when people thought plastics was the future, why, you might think, gee, how could I arrange my career or my kids' careers so that they could get into plastics? If space was the future, you thought, how could I be an astronaut or train my kids to be astronauts? Well, you know, what you think the future is going to be like affects how you set up your long-term plans and what you invest in.
Okay. Vanessa, same question. Ultimate fate of humanity, something we need to be thinking about now?
Yeah, I think it's always important to think about the future, and I think we've always kind of been doing that. Maybe for some, they're not thinking further than perhaps self-preservation or their own personal legacies they'll be leaving, or maybe the fate of their children, but it's not enough to just kind of think, you know, one generation ahead. You have to think, you know, maybe seven generations ahead. I think in the context of thinking about population growth, of environmental changes, of increasing complexity in all of our social, political, economic systems, you know, you can extrapolate out that we're headed for any kind of series of collapses. So I think in order to kind of mitigate that risk and think about what we can do now, as Robin said, that's going to be the determining factor of if we kind of head towards these apocalyptic scenarios where it's kind of every man for himself, or if we aspire towards something that is like a more unified vision of a globally connected, unified kind of ideal, or moving towards an ideal of something that, you know, aspires towards, you know, peace and cooperation.
You know, I heard from each of you some mention of potential existential risks that that we want to mitigate or avoid, and also just tremendous opportunities that we might want to take advantage of. And this harkens back to the show we did about existential risks a few weeks ago. But I want to ask this panel pretty much the same question, or one of the questions that that went to that panel as a follow up to Stephen's question, is if we're looking ahead at both these massive potential risks and massive potential opportunities, is there, do you lean one way or the other in terms of which we should be more focused on? Do we get serious about the risks and think primarily about those, or do we go for the benefits because we mitigate most of the risks by approaching those, by trying to make the good stuff happen? Vanessa, we'll leave that one with you since you spoke last. What do you think? Should we be working on maximizing gains or minimizing losses?
Yeah, I don't know about one over the other. I mean, to me, it's like something that's happening in tandem and in parallel and kind of co-evolving together. I mean, I think that the way a lot of things are set up, many of our systems are designed for certain kind of behaviors to come out, and in my opinion, many of them are not the kind of behaviors that we would think that are inherently positive ones. I mean, it's easy to kind of exploit for personal gain, to do things that are not altruistic in order to get ahead. So I think there needs to be new systems designed that incentivize the kind of positive behaviors that we want to see in the world. And while that's also going on, looking at all the root causes of the things that are going to lead to those risks and, you know, mitigating those as well. So I see both kind of happening at the same time.
Okay. John, what do you think? Should we be trying to make good stuff happen, trying to prevent bad things from happening? Or, as Vanessa says, am I making an unfortunate distinction there?
Well, no, I think you're making a really important one. You know, there's just tremendous psychological diversity in our species, and there are people who are, you know, natural optimists and natural pessimists, and people consider themselves realists, visionaries, evidence-backed people, and all of these types of people seem to be very important to the mix. And there's a book called Strengths Finder. You can take this $14 test online if you buy the book, $14 book, and put the code in. And it'll give you your top five strengths of, I think, 34 strengths that the Gallup organization has found. And you'll find certain strengths are actually, they correlate more with people that tend to be more optimistic, more kind of manager types, pushing people to do what they call stretch goals, do a little bit more than they actually can do, but they end up getting a lot done. And then certain types correlate more with kind of pessimism and realism. Now, you may have heard this expression, optimists. Pessimists are more accurate, but optimists get more done. I think it's a true phrase. And there's a book called Infotopia by Cass Sunstein, and it's a really nice book on prediction markets, which I know Robin's done a lot of work on. Discusses a couple hundred of them that have been used in various institutions, and one of the interesting things you find if you run a prediction market in your company is you can find people who are consistently negative but accurate, so the pessimists, and then you find these people who are consistently optimistic but maybe a little too visionary for their own good. And if you find people who are just a little bit too optimistic and put them give them managerial positions, and then you find the people that are kind of consistently pessimistic but right, and then give them the position right underneath the managers as like deputy managers to kind of deflate the balloon of the ego of these managers, you know, you really identified two types of people that are really important in getting things done. You know, the so-called, the people who are going to, the futurists call self-fulfilling prophecies. They're going to give a positive vision, and they're going to then rally the troops to get there. And then there's the so-called self-preventing prophecies, many of which I'm sure Vanessa would be able to tell us a lot about, you know, the kinds of ways the wheels could fall off the wagon on our developing planet. And if we tell those stories well, like, you know, Rachel Carson did in Silent Spring, or Helen Caldicott with nuclear power, et cetera, you know, then we can prevent that thing from actually happening because we get scared about it and we fix it. So it seems to me like we really have people telling
all those stories really well, the risks and the opportunities, and different types of people are going to be more naturally inclined to be excellent in one or the other of those areas.
And can you say, what was the name of that book again with the test? That sounded really interesting.
With what? Oh, it's called StrengthsFinder 2.0, and it's kind of like a Myers-Briggs or a Kiersey or Enneagram, but it's more validated, like Myers-Briggs is. And it's only a $15 book on Amazon, and I think it's a 30-minute test. Take it online, it'll tell you what your top five strengths are. And they recommend that you focus on those strengths in your job and your career, and don't try so hard to find other or to build yourself up in the other, I guess it would be 29 strengths that you're not as good at, but just find other people who have those skills, value them, build strength complementary teams, and learn how to give them, kick a problem over to them that they're good at that needs to be solved rather than trying to deal with it yourself. So it's a pretty interesting, that's actually Peter Drucker's philosophy, saying, you know, focus on your strengths and build cognitively diverse teams. And so it's a good book for helping people see that, you know, there's just multiple, I guess back to what Robin was saying, there's multiple stories we all tell, and they all, you know, or many of them seem to be really important, and they're all different.
Sounds like a great tool. Okay, Robin, same question to you. How, should we be focused more on preventing the bad stuff or bringing about the good stuff?
I mean, I'll agree with the other two that optimists and pessimists have their place in ordinary ventures and projects and organizations. But I'd say that for the long-term future, as long as a civilization continues to grow and be diverse and decentralized, you know, it's going to fill this vast universe, and that's such a vast potential that the overwhelming risk is that somehow that will be prevented, and it just won't happen at all. Having it happen 100 or 1,000 years later is just tiny compared to it not happening at all. So the overwhelming risk and concern is that somehow this whole thing never happens. So there's various kinds of risk, and I think it's mainly trading off these negative scenarios. And it could be that for the best way to prevent some negative scenarios is to go full speed ahead to try to grow as fast as we can to get past the risks that happen when we're small. But it's still trading off some bad things versus other bad things.
Okay, that's a great point. That if you're talking about the far future, you have to get to the far future. That there's this long term view, existential risk becomes a long term issue. We think about some of these things that seem imminent, and others that seem like, well, they might happen a really long time from now. But something that might happen a really long time from now keeps us from getting to the ultimate end. Great perspective there. Okay, so. Moving on to our next question. I want to key off something else that that you all said in answer to Stephen's first question, which as I heard it is the ultimate fate of humanity something that we need to be thinking about now. I believe each of you answered that in the affirmative. So I want to explore that a little bit further. I want to know what should we be doing as individuals? And let me phrase the question this way. How should my life be different day to day because I'm aware of and taking the far future into consideration? And Robin, we'll stick with you for that one.
Well, I think, as I said before, if you want to live to the future, then you should try to preserve your life and not die. And that includes, obviously, staying healthy and maybe doing something like cryonics. And if you want to think more about the farther future, then figure out what it will take to thrive there and what will be prosperous there. But I wouldn't really argue that for most people it's worth a lot of time and effort thinking about the distant future, but some people should do it. It's really a shame that it seemed to be very few people who really take it seriously.
Well, and you know, is that just a subset of the fact that I think people generally don't think about the future much anyway, even the near future, much less the far future?
Right, it's actually surprising that, say, in academia, there's far more people who study the past than the future, but there's far more we can do with knowledge about the future than we can do with knowledge about the past.
You know, amen.
We can choose where to go in the future. So it might be hard to learn things about the future, but it's not impossible, and it's just much more valuable.
And you would think that, keeping with that same idea, there should be a lot more future than there is past, we hope. right? So
absolutely,
it should be a bigger field of study for that reason. And in fact, really, the value in studying the past ought to be so that we take good advantage of that moving into the future.
Right. History should be a subset of future studies.
Wow. Well, we'll see. We'll see when that happens. That should happen in the mid future, I would think, is when that when that idea gets recognized. Okay, John, what do you think? How should my life be different day to day if I'm focused on the far future?
Well, I would slightly restate the question and say not focus on the far future, but have a big picture view of the world, and that big picture includes some definite ideas, hypotheses about where we're going, right? Well, one of the ways that I think things will be different is you'll have a sense of what progress is, because you'll have a sense of what you want to get to and what you're hoping your community and civilization gets to. And I think that's one of the really tough ones for science right now. We don't really have any good theories of progress. You know, what exactly is it? But if we have a sense of what it is, even though it's not perfect yet, I think not only are we more productive going toward the thing that we know we want to get closer to, because we've decided that that's important, but we actually, I think, learn more. And you know, us being lifelong learners and lifelong adapters is really, I think, one of the essential evolutionary opportunities that we have. You know, never has the world been going as fast as possible. Never have any human beings had as many opportunities in front of them as we do today. It's so easy when change goes faster to, you know, pull back into reactionism and fundamentalism. Several people have argued that the political polarization we see in the United States is kind of a small version of the fundamentalism that we've seen in many areas around the world as the disruptive effects of globalization have gone faster. But if we don't do that, if we don't put our heads in the sand and we decide, no, things are going faster than ever before, but I have an idea where things are going and where I want to go, then I think we can become more vibrant than ever, than any generation has ever been, not only more than our parents and, be able to see things, do things that they can't do, but we can start empowering others. I've discussed in my previous talks about this idea that we're developing a digital self, a digital twin. The conversational interface is moving us towards a cyber twin. That cyber twin is going to be a digital agent that's going to engage in weak personality capture of us. It's going to complete our sentences when we're having a senior moment. It's going to start advising us on our votes, on our where we spend our dollars. And it's going to push us towards, you know, what I've called a value cosm society, a world where you can surf the values, the public values people have, and you can actually see, you know, big actors like Walmart can know exactly who will pay to have a Walmart in their community and who will fight to keep one away. And we'll see more cultural diversity than ever before, more and more rapid change. And I think that'll all be because we have these weak digital selves, these extensions of ourselves that are learning way faster than we are. And if we embrace that and we are early adopter of the best social networks and computing platforms and, you know, mobile technology and being an activist with regard to that stuff and, you know, giving $5 a day to whatever we, you know, our favorite causes are, you know, putting our money aside, having that foresight to put, you know, if you put 20% of your income aside for, I think it's something like 20 years, I'm sure Robin can tell us the details, you know, there's a very short period of doing that before the money you're earning just from the global productivity that those dollars are capturing by investing them at, you know, 5 or 7% a year starts to outcompete your own salary. Mm. And, you know, books like Your Money or Your Life or the articles like The Permanent Portfolio, those will both give you great examples of how to invest in that way where, you know, you get freedom basically because you have this long-term perspective and you're trying to be as active as possible with your time, your resources, and your cognitive assets that you have. And so I think we're at the stage where if we treat our digital self seriously, we will greatly accelerate our impact on the world. And just to I know I've said a lot, but I'm going to conclude. I probably said more than I should, but I'm going to conclude with one plug for the Brain Preservation Society, because Robin has talked about cryonics a couple times so far, and I think that's an excellent, excellent way of thinking. If we can think about preserving not only all of our digital self, but our biological self when we die, and the Brain Preservation Society, foundation that I co-founded last year with a colleague at Harvard, Ken Hayworth, we're trying to figure out ways to lower the cost of very inexpensively and reliably preserving your neural structure when you die, so that it could be brought back and, as they call it, uploaded into this this digital self that that you and I are using today. And I think if we think of that self that we're using today, you know, these smartphones, these social networks, these all these collaborative wikis and tools we're using as just a natural extension of us, and we figure out how to preserve as much of the things we care about as possible, I think that's what keeps us on that curve. So I said a lot there, but that's what I would. That's what I would
focus it's a great outline, and you've taken us from day to day to ultimately why that brings us into the future. So I think that's a great talk through of that. Vanessa, I'm gonna ask you the same basic question, which is, what should our lives look like day to day as individuals? That's different if we're focused. We'll say not necessarily on the far future, but I like the way John. I like the way you put that. If we're focused on the big picture, what changes in individual day to day life?
Well, I'll jump off of what John said about it being a continuous learning process. That's definitely something that I strive to incorporate in my life on a day-to-day basis. And for me, it comes to, as far as what can we all be doing, really thinking about the evolution of consciousness and becoming more self-aware and understanding how we fit in as individuals into this larger thing that's going on around us, and being able to really think critically and think about the future in an intelligent way. And so it really, to me, is like a lot of psychological work, really contemplating personal identity. And I think as we move more and more online and have a digital twin or have these avatars or personas that are operating on our behalf, and also becoming more interconnected with others around the globe, despite time zone or geographic location, we kind of feel constantly connected to them. I think you begin to have a little bit of a dissolution of personal identity that can be very disruptive to that whole construction. And kind of, I think we're going to be evolving as people into even understanding like what it means to be an individual. So I think it's natural to look around the world around us and kind of want to fix all the problems out there and think about these technologies that we're going to create that are going to make everything better. And those things, you know, are happening, but sometimes we think about those at the expense of thinking about fixing the problems in here first, and what's going on in our own minds and how we're operating within this world. So in terms of thinking in the big picture, I think a good kind of compass or guidance structure is, what is the world that I would want to create? You know, if you're even thinking that big, like if I could really create my own world, which I feel like if you are expressing yourself, if you're allowing this kind of like inner you to come out, like what you manifest in the world is that thing, like you are creating something around you. And so kind of thinking like, what is the world I want to create? Okay, I have this vision. And then who am I in that world? Like how does that person operate in this environment that is the ideal in their mind? And just start acting like that today. Start leading by example. Start, you know, like kind of the kind of cliche of kind of be the change, you know, like start doing today what you think you would want to see in a society in the far future. And if you start taking those actions now, that's going to resonate into the future. It's going to touch every person that you come into interaction with, and then they're going to carry that forward too, and you don't know how they're going to, you know, make some other great thing happen in the world because of their interaction with you. So I think for me that's an inspirational way to think about how to live my life, is that, you know, if I can continue to keep that vision of what I want to see and do it as much as I can for myself, that'll carry forward.
That terrific perspective. Thanks for that.
Yeah, well said,
Vanessa. Stephen, I'm gonna let the host chime in on this one as well. What do you think people should be doing differently day to day if they've got the big picture in mind?
I like to see it. You know, obviously taking care of our own health is a big part of it, and you know, I think it's a you know, we get the leadership we deserve a lot of times, and you know, the very fact that some of our I think it's fair to say all of our leaders, just about, there are very few that are really aware of some of the changes that are coming and how fast they can be coming.
Right.
There's this linear view of, well, there are going to be, you know, developments obviously, but any takeoff here in the near future or anything. And you know, perhaps we should try to support people that who actually understand some of these issues. You know, I mean, perhaps that's some things that we could do. So
maybe find some and things? Get them running for office. Wouldn't that be
exactly? What do you think, Phil?
Well, I would agree with what you just said, and just picking up on what Robin has mentioned a couple times, which is the idea of living long enough to get to the future, which is kind of, Stephen, what you were echoing with live to see it. And I think, you know, there's an interesting side of that, that even if you're not planning to make it into the future, talking about something that, John, both you and Vanessa mentioned, which is that we do have this kind of digital self that is emerging. I wrote a piece on my day job blog, I don't know, probably 6 months ago, this is a really sad case about a school teacher who lost her job because a porn video she was in many years ago surfaced on the web, and the fact that really we have this amazing persistent digital footprint anymore. I mean, whether we want to or not, whether people are trying to create something that's going to live forever in the cloud or not, people are doing it, and you would think that people would want to be aware of the fact that there are aspects of themselves or aspects of things that they have done that you know, for good or for ill, are going to live on past the next few weeks or the next few months, possibly for years or possibly even for who knows, for centuries. So we've already got a foot in the future. It seems to me that the very first step would be just to recognize that we've already started moving into the future.
So I'm surprised that we've been talking this long without talking about what the distant future is actually going to be like.
Oh, we're getting there.
We're going to get there, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. As a matter of fact, let me just go ahead and ask my. Okay. let me just throw this out to the panel. This is kind of a twin question with Phil's. What should we be doing as individuals? Let me just ask, what should society be doing? What work does society need to be doing to get to this future? And let me just put it this way. You know, calculus was invented by a couple of different guys nearly simultaneously. You know, writing was invented independently several different times. So there's some things that just it's like you know, it's a required next step. It's going to come from somewhere. So what is, you know, what is specifically some things that need to happen now? And I guess Vanessa, let me start with you.
So what do you mean when you say society? That could mean a lot of different things.
Okay.
Well, not individually. I think that's the point, right? We talked about what individuals need to do. So whether it's business or government or NGOs or, you know, self-forming ad hoc groups or whatever.
R&D departments or, you know, whatever.
Well, I guess on one hand, I'd say society is in need of a new narrative that. it's kind of broken right now, and there seems to be a lot of confusion and uncertainty and people looking for that vision of what are we doing? Like, what is the next step? We don't really know, and we're in the process of it. Like, we're in transition, and no one knows how we're going to come out on the other end. So I guess kind of forming that collective story would be one thing that society could be doing. I think it would be lovely to see a lot of the games and kind of propaganda and media manipulation to go away more. And, you know, we're seeing that struggle taking place with information wanting to be free and people beginning to demand more transparency when they see that informed decision-making leads to happier people. And I think that, again, this comes to the mental work of individuals and groups of being able to kind of transcend their own egos to be able to collaborate across boundaries, across silos, across countries, and various, you know, jurisdictions and barriers that we've put up, because I think the world is going to get faster and increasingly complex, and it's going to require a lot more interoperability, both in the way that all of our created systems operate and also in the way that we think about things. And I think as we continue to quantify the world, and it makes it easier to see what the results are short and long term of various actions, you know, that is going to kind of put us in a position where we have to be a lot more cooperative on a societal or global level, knowing that, you know, what happens in this one place isn't isolated. It's all interconnected. It's all interrelated, and we're going to have to kind of work together if we want to move towards a more positive future.
Robin, what do you think we need to be doing as a society? Work that needs to be done.
I'm going to set the context here a bit. We are the future of the past, and the future is just another place in space and time. It's not the realization of our hopes and dreams. It's not a story to inspire us or a lesson to warn us. It will be what it is largely on its own terms, and we will have a limited ability to influence it, just like if people in the distant past had had some image of what we would be like, they still would have had only a limited ability to influence what we've become. So I think the first thing is to have a rough idea of what it's likely to be and then maybe have some hope to push it on the margin one way or another. But I think there's a tendency to vastly overrate our influence and what we can do. The Industrial Revolution happened, and it was going to happen at some point, and if people had imagined it 1,000 years before, they couldn't have made it not happen necessarily or made it be a vastly different thing, but maybe they could have had it happen in one place first or another place a little differently. So I think the first order of business is to say, what is the distant future likely to actually be like if we do nothing different, if it just ends up being what it ends up being? And then maybe look a little on the margin how to push it one way or the other. And it's not going to be a nirvana. It's not going to be the grand thing we all decide it's going to be heaven and work for, because that's not how these things work. We aren't a heaven today. We never were a heaven, but some things get better, some things don't get worse. So, I mean, I'm prepared to go into a little more about what I think the future is likely to be like on different timescales, but I'm not sure if you're ready for that.
No, that's our next question, actually. So we'll jump to that next after John tells us what he thinks we should be doing at a societal level.
Okay. Well, I have to agree with the comments of both of my panelists so far, but I would add a little bit of a caveat, I think, to the statements of Robin about we have less influence than we think, and I think he's absolutely right on a global scale, but on a local scale, I think we're getting more and more influence than we've ever had before. So it's the whole Margaret Mead, you know, never underestimate the effect that a small committed group can have on the system. Indeed, it's the only thing that's ever caused change, you know, the small committed group idea. You know, if society is an evolutionary process, then as Stephen Jay Gould says, you know, you're going to see increasing variety and specialization over time. That's the signature. Think of the Darwin's tree of life. There's just going to be more twigs on that tree. There's going to be more branches at the top. And more small branches. And if that's what we're going to a world where
everything's going to be connected up. You know, this skin of electronic connectivity is going to be so dense. The level of transparency is going to be so high. The sensors, the effectors, the robotics, the artificial intelligence, the AI, and all of the manufacturing automation and abundance that goes with that. And then the IA, the intelligence amplification that comes from all these digital twins and electronic extensions that we're using, then I think you can say in that, if that's the kind of future we're creating, then a whole lot of evolution is going to happen. A whole lot more subcultures are going to emerge. People are going to be able to be, do, see, think, feel more uniquely than ever before, highly, highly subspecialized in the interests that they have, aesthetically and scientifically and socially, economically, politically. And so if that's really the big picture trend, and I think it is from my perspective, then we should be thinking a lot more about what's driving that. If this is accelerating technologies that are driving that, how do I enable those? How do I, you know, look at how Apple destabilized music and publishing, and it's going to destabilize television shortly, you know, with ITV, whatever that's going to be. Look at how the PC disintermediated the hierarchies of the corporation and flattened them. Look at what the internet and mobile and wearable is doing. Look at Twitter and, you know, Google Plus and Wikipedia are doing to create incredible new collective intelligence and specialization. You know, I just Google a town during Hurricane Irene, and like my girlfriend did, and I can find out on Twitter stream, you know, exactly what's happening there. So if I think of all those things, all those digital extensions of me as me, then even though things go faster every year and there's more and more difficulty for me as an individual to affect the system, if I think of all those extensions as me, and if I make sure those extensions just keep improving and I adopt them and I push them as hard as I can, I use them, I recommend them to my friends, and I jump on the best ones. I'm an early adopter. Then I think I can be happy that I'm doing some very powerful social things. You know, this Arab Spring we've seen with Twitter and Facebook, it's nothing compared to the level of democratization that might hit our planet with another 10 years of these technologies advancing. So if that's the way you look at it, that's your particular big picture, that these digital things make the planet more like a network and make the individual nodes more powerful at the expense of the hierarchies, you know, the big corporations and the governments, then you want to push that network as hard as you can, and you'll change all of society. You'll put all of society in this transparent, intelligent cage of kind of machine intelligence long before, you know, we get the singularity you know, we can transcend our biology and all of those good things. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, that I think sets the stage. Now we can ask the question we've all been waiting for. I will say that before we started the broadcast this evening, we were talking amongst ourselves informally, and the question came up as to whether there would be any crosstalk between this segment and the later segment of the show where we talked to Kevin Kelly. And actually, there will be in how I'm going to phrase this next question, because now we're going to describe the distant future. We're going to describe the ultimate destiny of humanity. And I want to start by talking about what we'll be hearing from Kevin Kelly here in a few minutes. In his book, What Technology Wants, he describes technology as quote, infinite game. And he talks about the future of humanity potentially being an infinite opening up of possibilities for happiness, for fulfillment, and for meaning in our lives. He also, Robin, to your point from just a moment ago, makes a very strong case that he's not a utopian. He makes a distinction around being a protopian rather than a utopian, but simply that we can continue moving in these positive directions forever. So my question to the panel is, would you use similar terms in describing what the ultimate future might have in store for us? And if not, can you give us your best assessment, looking as far into the future as you care to look, of what finally happens to humanity? And Robin, I know you've been eager to talk to us about this, so we'll start this one with you.
Oh boy. Well, first of all, it's really different to talk about what will current trends lead into and what is sort of the culmination of recent and anticipated near-term trends, that's completely different from talking about what will the long-term future be like.
Right.
The long-term is a really long time. So I'd say talking about a million to a trillion years, that's the long-term future, whereas looking at Twitter and things like that, that's all sort of the last few years and maybe the next century. So the really long-term, I think we can say a lot of things with some confidence about, and they're really quite different than now, and it's really very different from what we expect in the near future, even over the next century. In the really long term, obviously one thing, as John said, is the future will be huge. It will be vast. There'll be vast space in there for variety and difference and different cultures and different personalities and styles of thinking. It'll be just so unimaginably almost huge that what we imagine as diversity is just a tiny fraction of what that could be. But another thing that's robust that we should be able to say about the distant future is that change will be slow then. I mean, we're in this period of really rapid change, even increasing change, and that'll happen for a while, but it just can't go on for another million years, and it certainly can't go on for another billion years. Eventually, we will expand, we will fill up the volume of space around here, we will explore the space of different technological possibilities, and then we'll just sort of run out of space to fill up, and we'll run out of technological possibilities to explore, and we'll have a relatively stable world where things don't change.
Robin, can I clarify one thing? When you say we'll fill up the space around here, you're talking about the universe, is that right?
Yes, right.
Yeah, okay.
Presumably the speed of light limit is a limit, and we'll expand at the speed of light. If it's not a limit, then we'll expand it even faster, but we'll fill it all up. And then once we're in this very stable world, growth rates will be very slow, technological innovation rates will be very slow, and those creatures will be very well adapted to their world. Our distant ancestors were very well adapted to their world, but then recently we've become these strange creatures out of time where we have all these habits and inclinations that made sense in our distant past, and we're in this strange different world, and the things we do don't make as much sense, so we're not very well adapted to our world. It's part of the charm and the strangeness of our current, what I call the dream time. But in the distant future, they will again be very well adapted to their circumstances, and that, then we can make a lot of predictions based on that. Presumably relatively low growth rates, low interest rates, more of a Malthusian equilibrium, where they're sort of near the carrying capacity of their environment. And that's a really dramatically different world than the world we're living in. And it's a dramatically different world than the world we might see over the next century with accelerating, increasing change and growth and all sorts of exciting things happening.
So just to, if I can summarize a little bit, it sounds like so we fill up the universe, we actually get off the growth curve because we're done, right? We hit a kind of a stasis, and when you talk about the kind of Malthusian limits, does that mean that in the future the people will be poor? Is that what you're saying?
Basically, I mean, they could have vast to buy and things to do that we just don't have possible, just as, you know, even poor people today can buy spectacular cool things that our ancestors couldn't. But yeah, relative to some sort of life of leisure, they'd be more at the edge of being able to, you know, barely afford surviving.
Right.
Almost all our ancestors have always been, right? The entire animal world, the entire biological world is like that. And all our history up until 300 years ago, almost every human was like that.
So
when you talk about the carrying capacity, Robin, that's the carrying capacity of a morning filled with 400 billion suns, right? So
right, so it's huge. Absolutely, it's huge. And so
yeah.
The number of these creatures is absolutely enormous.
Yeah.
So it's almost like we complete we come full circle, because we go from being well adapted to our environment and living at the subsistence level in the past, through this dream time, and we did a show talking with you about the dream time a while back, into a future where for all the fact that we're incredibly capable and incredibly diverse and amazing things have happened, those limits finally surface, and we're living at the subsistence level again, and once again we're doing it in such a way that we're well adapted to our environment.
That's the story.
Wow. Okay. Quite a story. All right. Vanessa, what story do you have for us about the future? Would you agree with Kevin Kelly's language about an infinite opening up of possibilities? Would you buy into Robin's talk of Malthusian limits, or where do you want to take us in the far future?
Well, I don't think I've really contemplated Robin's future all that much. It's almost too far away. I mean, I've read enough science fiction that I follow what he's talking about, but it's just so removed from you know, my conception that it's almost, it almost makes me ask, like, why even think that far ahead? It's almost like maybe a caveman, trying to explain to caveman what today was like, you know, maybe just wouldn't even really compute. So, you know, he's describing a world that is kind of based in a different kind of substrate or information universe that is almost inconceivable. So I'll just bring it back to, I guess, a more human, more what I think of today as human terms. And I actually just finished Kevin Kelly's book, and I liked what he had to say. I liked the context of kind of like my takeaway was that the purpose of evolution is to evolve, and humanity and our technologies, and not just humanity, but all, I guess, all species have been co-evolving over time and will continue to do so. And, you know, in my short life, I have seen that my interaction with technologies, as I learn how to use them effectively towards goals that I define for myself, do open up a larger range of choices and possibilities. So I would agree with that. So if you are thinking about how to kind of optimize your life based on your available technologies and resources, then yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think in a more ideal future, I would love to see that access to each other, to information, to the web becomes this human right, that we're all connected or can be if we want to, that we can transact and interact freely and kind of manifest beauty in the world in our own unique expressions. But I don't know that that's what's going to actually happen. It seems that people with more resources and means will have access to the newer technologies, to intelligence enhancers, to genetic engineering, to different kinds of learning opportunities, and perhaps the divide will continue to grow. And maybe this is part of what both Rob and John said about increased diversity and adaptation, that, you know, maybe some people will just be left behind. And in the future, there will be humans that are like the humans today, and they're still living in an agricultural society. And at that same, you know, moment, there are also those who live within a virtual space and are going through interstellar time travel, or are living forever, or, you know, kind of operating, you know, in a space that we can't really conceive of, that language has evolved to a different kind of mind-to-mind connection. And they're both kind of coexisting, and there's a range of different ways of being, and it just continues to grow. And there never is that one kind of nirvana or pinnacle or here we are, we've made it, this is what humanity was here to achieve, that it just kind of continues to go on forever.
All right, so a continuous process. It sounds like tremendous diversity that can result from that. All right, John, what do you think?
Wow, well, we're really getting into the tough one here. I think, as you know, I've started this little research community, EvoDevo Universe, and you can find our stuff online and some of the articles we've written about and some of the research topics. But when we look at the long-term future, you know, everyone has a big picture, a theory, a model, and the model that I find most useful is this model of evolutionary development, this idea that both evolution and development are occurring simultaneously in any complex system, like we see with two identical twins. All the features about them that look the same over their life cycle are developmental, and all the features about them that look different, which is basically everything at the molecular scale and everything at the tissue level, is evolutionary. It's adaptive, competitive, happens in a kind of a chaotic, bottom-up, selectionist manner, contingent, unpredictable manner. And so the fingerprints, retinal prints, the way the brains are wired up, the ideas in the heads of those twins, the choices they're going to make in their lives, those are all evolutionary. And so, you know, when we look at the two different futures that we've just been discussing, this 100-year future that you know, Vanessa has eloquently asked this question, you know, on the developmental or
on the 100-year scale, are we going to see increasing rich-poor divide or decreasing? I think we absolutely have to ask that question, and we have to get closer to an answer. I think the evidence is becoming clear that the rich-poor divide globally is decreasing. If you go to Gapminder and look at the gapminder.org projections from 1970 to, 20, I think they go out to 2020 now, you see these two-hump income distribution for the planet, the rich countries and the poor countries. Looks like a two-hump camel. And the closer we get to the present time, it's become more like a one-hump camel. So we're actually seeing globally this network phenomenon is decreasing rich-poor divides. And I feel pretty strongly that pretty soon there's, you know, our cyber twins are going to be advising us when we buy something. It's going to tell us the multiplier in between the highest paid and the lowest paid CEO in the company or employee of the company that we're thinking of buying from. And if we're thinking of buying from a country, it'll tell us the highest to lowest paid salaries in that country. And, of course, many European countries now have rich redistribution tax rates that are closing that rich-poor divide. It's not true in the United States or Switzerland or the UK or a few other, or China, a few other countries that are world-leading or emerging nations. But in the maturing industrial democracies, we're seeing a rationalization, something that looks more like a network, more like an integrated organism. And I would call that development. That's not evolution. But what we're seeing in, let's say, the Wild West of China today, where the rich people are, or in the United States for the last 50 years, where the rich top 5% and 10% are earning way more, way faster than the rest of the society. So we're seeing an increasing divide in those countries. I think that's more like an evolutionary process. That's more of a diversification, competition, individuation, specialization, and we're not seeing this integration, this immune system, this coming regression to mean that we see in developmental processes. And so I think you got multiple stories happening all over the planet, and we want to understand those stories better. And I think we would all agree that if we start treating the future more seriously, we start seeing some science and system theory funding for these things, we're not only going to tell better stories in the short range, but we're going to be able to argue more intelligently over the long range. And so now to get to the longer range that was just discussed eloquently by Robin, where he makes the point that we'll see vast new diversity, but we may see a slowing down of total change at some point. And we have this kind of a hybrid species. Humans might be a hybrid species that's not so well developed. I think that there's a great opportunity for that question to be resolved, not in the far future, but, you know, soon. I mean, the next few decades, the next few years even, we can start getting some clearer models because there are differences of opinion around that issue. And I agree entirely with him about the diversity point. And I agree with the hybrid point, but I would say the reason why we're not so well adapted as hybrids is probably because we're biological, as Tim Taylor says in The Artificial Ape. You know, since we picked up the first stone and started throwing it collectively, you know, as a group towards the predators, you know, now we're the baddest creatures on the savannah because, you know, 15 of us can throw this stone at 70 miles an hour towards the leopard. You know, no one's going to touch us from that point forward. We're just sitting around the campfire talking about how to make our stones, you know, sharper and put them on sticks and all that. So we're this weird creature that's a hybrid of biology and technological, and that's why we're not so adapted, because we're in this unique case where we're in the process of creating this post-biological thing. And if that's true, then we want to get to that post-biological thing as quickly as we can, that technological intelligence, that autonomous post-biological life. And so, you know, that's something we might understand that more clearly with more study. And then on maybe the big question where Robin and I are maybe on the opposite sides of the fence is this, you know, we have to reach the stasis period in the long-range future. Well, I agree with him in this universe. So maybe we're not on the same page. I don't know. But I would say that the most unusual thing that we've seen in the last several millennia from a big picture standpoint, is this continuous accelerating change. And I would argue that that's going to continue right down to the smallest scale at which we can port intelligence. And as Richard Feynman said in 59, there's plenty of room at the bottom. There's also plenty of performance at the bottom. Whenever we mess around, whenever we humans muck around with these very small scales of space and time and matter and energy, we get these tremendous returns. And that's a huge lesson for us in terms of technology development. I just recently read that since we started messing around with fusion power in 1970, was the first time we got any power out of the fusion reaction, we've increased our energy output a billionfold since then. So that's what's that? That's 41 years, and we've increased it a billionfold. And we're getting very close to the 21 times output that we need for energy input. That makes it on par with conventional forms of fossil fuel power generating plants, the so-called demo reactor. Many people think that within 10 years, like the folks at SR.org, because we've progressed so fast in our understanding of these incredibly small scales, and now we have catalysts. We can create synthetic catalysts at the last Foresight conference that are a million times more energy efficient in a catalytic reaction than what we had before, 10 to the 6. A guy made a micro laser in 2005 that was a million times more energy efficient than the previous micro lasers we had. You know, and these kinds of single-step advances, 10 to the 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, sometimes all the way up to 10 to the 6, like I said, in a single step seems to be characteristic of inner space. So this acceleration, if we're able to port our intelligence into inner space rather than outer space, that's, I guess, the big question here, right, the big picture question. If intelligence just becomes pretty much immune from existential threats because it kind of drops below the whole level of the universe that we're operating at now, what Werner Vinge would call these zones of space-time, and we just get out of this kind of old, slow, simple space that we're in now down into this something closer to the basement level of structure of our universe, but now we're reordering all of that matter and energy, like Feynman said, to do more intelligent computation than it did when it first emerged, then maybe that acceleration can continue all the way down, as far down as the physics allows us. And like I've said in my paper on the transcendence hypothesis, if you Google transcendence hypothesis, you'll find my 2011 paper on that. I think black holes might be a destiny for us. We might take that inner space ride all the way down to the level of something that looks like a black hole from our perspective, and pretty much just escape right out of this system into something far more interesting. And that's huge speculation right now. But I think we're finally giving ourselves permission to ask these questions. And I think there's huge, like Robin, I agree. That there's huge insight. Everyone doesn't need to be doing this, but as long as society is giving resources for some of us to do this, I think we could learn a whole lot that will give us better technology policy, and other policy today, down to what we do as individuals.
Okay, so a great diversity amongst the three of you in terms of visions of the distant future, and I'm afraid that actually takes us right to the end of our time. So the juxtaposition of the Malthusian future versus ultimate progress, kind of ongoing unraveling future versus the who knows, maybe we transcend this universe altogether. Those will be the three pictures that we have to look at. I want to thank each of you, Robin, Vanessa, and John, for being with us. Thanks for your perspectives. What a pleasure talking to all three of you. Now we'll go to the second segment of this program, which is our interview with Kevin Kelly, which was previously recorded.
I'm delighted to welcome our special guest to round out the World Transform 2. Kevin Kelly is senior maverick at Wired Magazine. He co-founded Wired in 1993 and served as its executive editor from its inception until 1999. He's also editor and publisher of the Cool Tools website, which gets 500,000 unique visitors per month. From 1984 to 1990, Kelly was publisher and editor of the Whole Earth Review, a journal of unorthodox technical news. He co-founded the ongoing Hackers Conference and was involved with the launch of The Well, a pioneering online service started in 1985. He authored the best-selling New Rules for the New Economy and the classic book on decentralized emergent systems, Out of Control. His most recent book is called What Technology Wants, published late last year. Kevin Kelly, welcome to The World Transformed.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, now, we're going to be recording this interview a few weeks ahead of the scheduled air date for the final installment of The World Transform, but I wanted to let you know that as it stands now, you, Kevin, get the last word on The World Transform, not only for this series, but since our topic is human destiny, you get the final say on what is to become of humanity. So I hope you ate your Wheaties this morning.
I did, and I hope people are prepared because I probably have one of the most optimistic views around.
And that's why we picked you, I have to say, acknowledging my own biases here. Now, let's start by talking a little bit about your book. Some might think it's a little odd to conclude a discussion of human destiny by discussing ideas from a book called What Technology Wants. But anyone who's been following The World Transformed over these 10 weeks knows that we see technology as a relentless driver and transformer of our world. And it appears to be both the means by which we change the world and the means by which the world changes us. And that seems to be one of the key ideas that I found in your book.
Indeed. I defined technology broadly enough to suggest that, first of all, its roots precede humanity, in fact, even precede life, that the same forces that run through the technium, this technological system, actually began the Big Bang, this self-organizing thread that self-organized life and then self-organized minds and self-organized technology now and will pass through us and beyond. This force is something that has infiltrated us to such an extent that we are, in almost any realistic way that you want to measure, technology ourselves. We are technological, so it's not just something that is outside of us. Humanity itself is a technological invention. We as humans are technological. We are domesticated like the animals that we have domesticated and made slightly technological, and so we can say in a certain way that we are the first domesticated animals. And in that sense, I think that understanding the future of humanity, it's necessary to understand the future of technology. The two are actually very tied together.
I would say partly domesticated, maybe. You know, kind of like wolves. Sometimes you see them domesticated, and sometimes not. That's a really interesting idea because it seems to turn things on their heads. Normally, we think of technology as being something that we created, but you're talking about technology as being something that, to an extent, has created us. Is it that we're coexistent life forms on the planet? Are we like siblings in some strange family, or what's the relationship between the two of us?
Well, it's very interesting. We are a self-created species. And once you are self-created, that means that you are both the creator, in every legitimate sense of the word, and also the created. And so that's the origin of our very conflicted position to technology. Are we in charge of technology, or is technology in charge of us? And the answer is that it's both. We are master of technology, and we are the servant of it. Sometimes it's doing exactly what we want, and other times we are doing what it wants. And it's not an either-or, it's an and. We are symbiotic in that sense with the things that we have created, because it has now created us. And so we will forever want to try to unravel these, but in, you know, 1,000 years from now, we will still be wrestling with the fact that in some senses we do what technology wants, in the other senses it's something that it's obeying us. But both are going on, and that's the destiny that we have.
So could you tell a little about the idea that technology is selfish? I found that very interesting in your book, and yet somehow it also seems to be designed to do to meet our needs. How do those two ideas work together?
The idea that technology is selfish and also that it is serving us is inherent in the nature of anything that is a self-created system. And we are like parents to the technological inventions, where they are our children, our mind children, and in the same way that children in some ways are partly us with our genes, they inherit so many of our genes that they are, and they're destined by that genetic makeup to some extent. At the same time, they are their own individual entities and can make free will choices. And I think our technological system is very much like that. There is a sense in which it is selfish, it's going to try to arrange the world so it can persist and continue to grow. At the same time, it is something that has come from us, and we have great influence, and we have great free will in it as well. And that position of being both under it and over it, we don't really have a very good vocabulary for that. There's not a lot of words that really indicate that kind of a position where one is both master and servant at the same time. But I think that's what we'll have to grow in the future is a better vocabulary for understanding this curious position.
I think the parent-child analogy is a good one for capturing some part of that, because there are definitely aspects of that in raising children.
Sure. I mean, are you if your child does something, are you responsible?
Right.
To some extent you are, and to some extent you're not. And it's always a kind of very complicated blend of the two that is something in itself different than just either being solely responsible or completely unresponsible.
Now, in the book, you make the argument that technology is, in fact, itself a life form, a continuation of evolution. Is that a metaphor, or do you mean that literally?
It is a metaphor, but it works as a metaphor, but I believe that it actually is an extension of the forces that were at work in life. And let me make it clear what I mean by it, what I mean by technology. I don't mean that your iPhone is alive or your light bulbs are a living organism or cars. What I mean is the entire system of all those developments and all those inventions together. Your car requires thousands of other technologies to create it and maintain it. Your iPhone's the same way, and each of those sub-technologies will require hundreds of other technologies to create them and sustain and operate them. And so anything that we make these days is really a network of very interrelated specimens and species of technology. And I'm interested in that larger system of all the technologies today and how they self-support each other. That system itself has the attributes of an evolutionary system. It is operating in the same way that life is at the largest, highest level. There are, of course, differences between a MacBook and a sunflower, but there are so many similarities that we can understand the long-term trends in the technium as basically the same long-term trends that run through the 4 billion years of life on Earth.
Is it fair to say that evolution of the technium has replaced or supplanted human evolution, that we stopped evolving as an organism or as a species, and that that evolution is being carried on by the technium?
That was a very popular notion for the last 30 or 40 years. The evolutionary viewpoint was that when culture came along, that all the thrust of evolution was sort of transferred to cultural evolution, and that our bodies stopped evolving because the kind of the pressure of adaptation moved to culture, and we could teach ourselves how to adapt in a kind of Lamarckian sense. One of the big promoters of that was actually Stephen Jay Gould, who actually, his reputation has sort of been dimming a little recently because many of the things that he claimed have been shown not to be true, and I think that's one of them. We now have genetic evidence from gene sequencing that, in fact, our human bodies are now evolving almost 100 times faster than they were 10,000 years ago when culture began. Mm. So in a very surprising way, the thrust of evolution has been accelerated by the technium and by culture, and our biological organisms are now adapting at a much faster rate. And we can see evidences of this at the rapidity in which humans adapted, say, adult lactose tolerance once they domesticated herding animals. And there are other examples of human biological evolution becoming very, very rapid and much to everybody's surprise, much faster than it was before culture.
So that's interesting when you mention the acceleration of human evolution. I think it's also fair to say it's a certainly popular trope here at Fast Forward Radio and the World Transformed that technological evolution is occurring at an accelerated pace. Is it outpacing us in terms of the rate at which it's accelerating, or do you see the two happening more or less hand in hand?
Well, that is the great fear, and also I think a legitimate concern, is that the pace of technological change, the technium or cultural change, is certainly happening much faster than our innate biological speed of change. Even though it's much faster than it was before, it's obviously not as fast as the cultural change and the technological change around us. And so the fear is whether this gap between how fast we're changing in our bodies and how fast our culture is changing is what, you know, Alvin Toffler called future shock, whether it's sort of toxic. And I think that if we kept the idea that we were only biological creatures and not technological, that would be a source of great concern. But the fact is that we are becoming more symbiotic with our technology. And so, you know, we're offloading lots of our brain functions to the internet, or memory functions, just like we offloaded it to reading and writing. And so I think that it's not necessary that our biological being develop as fast as the technium, because we are living more and more in the technium. We are using our tools to extend our senses and to extend our self, the extended self, into this technium, and that's where more of what we're interested in is going to happen. And so I think that what we're seeing is a very rapid evolution of what it means to be human and what the nature of humanity is. And I think there's sort of no end to how fast that could go.
So does that... let me put it this way. How does that fit in with an idea such as the technological singularity, which, among other ways of looking at it, might be that the evolution of technology just so outpaces the evolution of humanity that one gets sort of, in some sense, left behind the other? In your reading of the situation, that doesn't happen because we're sort of along for the ride. Is that fair to say?
I'm not a big fan of the singularity as a metaphor or even as a reality, for a number of reasons. First of all, I don't think there is an end point in evolution. I don't think there is an omega point that it's all moving towards. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very clear that every living organism on Earth, all the, you know, 30 million, however million, we actually don't know, different species there, all of them, from the cockroach to the starfish to the ostrich to us, are all equally evolved. We have specimens and species alive today have an equal amount of evolution, which is, you know, 3.7 billion years. We've all been here at the same time. We all have the same amount of evolution. And so there's an outward radial expansion of evolution. It's not like climbing a ladder towards an endpoint. So that's the first thing to say, is that we are on a journey with a lot of other organisms and species, and we have all evolved together in equal distance. And the second reason why I think the singularity isn't working or isn't going to be something that is real or going to be real for us is because when we go through a singularity, it's invisible. We've already been through one singularity as defined not as the endpoint, but as a transition into another level. And that singularity was our evolution of the language. So pre-language, it was impossible for us to kind of imagine what the world after language is going to be like. It just, invention of language moved us into a completely new realm of a new hierarchical level of evolution. But that process was completely invisible during it. There was no moment when the Neanderthals or whoever acquired language were sitting around a campfire saying to one another, wait, do you guys realize that we're actually talking right now?
I mean, right.
This is like language. Wow, did you realize what we... No, that never happened, because it was only in kind of long retrospect that we can kind of see that we're through it. And I think that going through whatever changes we are going to go through, which we are, will seem very ordinary and not this sort of discontinuous disjunction. And that's because I'm kind of defining the singularity as in the weak sense of a movement to a new level of organization, probably planetary, And most likely something where there are multiple different kinds of minds. I think the strong version of the singularity as the invention of some superintelligence that's going to arrive and solve all our problems as a species and give us immortality and downloads into computers, I think there's a lot of reasons why that strong version is a beautiful, fantastic, utterly important myth. Myth meaning that it's like Superman. It's a wonderful mythic idea that will never go away, but doesn't mean that it's true. It's something that you have to kind of confront and deal with on a mythic level. And I think as a myth, it's very powerful, but I think it's not really real. And it's always going to be kind of in front of us coming someday for the next 1,000 years.
That's interesting. I want to come back to the mythological nature of that. But your commentary about language and the development of language and it as a singularity reminded me of something else in the book, which is the discussion of how much better off we are from a standard of living standpoint than people in previous generations. And I've often had this scenario that I introduce where you find somebody from the year 1500 or from the year 1200 or, you know, somewhere back a few hundred years. And if you're able to communicate with them, you start showing them the way you live, the things you have, the things you're able to do, and they're completely astounded, right, by all these capabilities. And you talk about the number of possessions that a person has in their house. You know, suddenly they're dealing with this person who has greater wealth than the king, who has more power in some ways than the strongest armies, who has more wisdom than at their fingertips than the wisest person in the world. And you convey some aspect of what life is like for us today. And they're convinced, utterly convinced, that we live in utopia, that we live in paradise. And the probably most incredible thing that you could tell those people would be, oh no, my life is very difficult and fraught with problems. That would probably be the hardest thing for them to swallow. And I think that utopias are all kind of relative, right? They're subjective from the side that you're on. Is it possible that could be the same with singularities?
Yeah, I'm not in any way a utopian. I am what I call a protopian. Meaning,
okay,
so
what's the difference there?
A utopian is a destiny where everything is worked out and everything is kind of perfected and there's less problems than there are today. A protopian is this idea that we're on a direction rather than a destiny, that it's progressive, that we're getting a little tiny better every day, and that betterness is not coming from the abolition of problems, but by the increase in choices. And so every day we have a few more choices than before, and that accumulation of choices is what we call progress. So progress is something that it's not a destiny where there is no problems. It's a direction in which we keep increasing the number of choices and possibilities. And so I believe in progress, that it's true, that today is better than yesterday by a little bit. Not by very much, by a little bit, but that's sufficient over time.
And is it fair to say that with new choices will always come new problems, but you seem to be better off in the world with the new problems and the new choices than you were in the world with the old problems and the fewer choices?
Right. The problems are the cost of choices, and it's the whole fundamental dilemma of free will is that if you allow free will, you allow the choices for problems, you allow the option for problems. But most of the times, problems are usually opportunities for further new choices. And so the whole dilemma of being a god, that if you were a god and making a world and you were to introduce free will, there's only free will if you allow problems, if you allow wrong choices, if you allow people to do harm. And so the nature of the universe is that it's fundamentally that free will is somehow at work in a system of physics and energy that's completely deterministic. And I think fundamentally that movement towards free will is really what self-organization is doing. It's actually in some ways rearranging things so that there's more choices at the end than when it began. And we don't really understand what the connection is, whether it's informational or what, but the general movement is towards the movement of the universe is towards increasing diversity, increasing specialization, increasing complexity, all of which increase the number of possibilities in the world. And so I'm a possibilian, and I think that we're moving towards increasing possibilities. And that is what is that's a protopian view. That's not a utopian view.
Okay, I see the distinction now. You know, one of the things you mentioned in the book that caught my attention is that in previous generations, people did not experience new things all that often. And you referenced future shock earlier. Mm-hmm. That we live in an age now when we encounter new things all the time and seemingly at an increasing pace. What do you say to those who would argue that we already have too many choices and that the problem is that we now have too many options, that we need to start cutting things back and living more, you know, the argument comes we need to be more sustainable rather than mm-hmm. constantly expanding.
Yeah, so one of the views that what technology wants, even suggested in its title, is trying to promote is the idea of looking at the world through the eyes of technology, through the eyes of technium. Richard Dawkins, the biologist, did a wonderful jujitsu on the intellectual world by suggesting that we look at biology through the eyes of genes, the selfish mm-hmm. gene, where it's a chicken, you know, of course, is really kind of the gene's way of propagating more chicken genes. And one would expect that when he looked at his own children, he did not just see them as kind of a package of a system for making more Dawkins genes, that he actually saw more in them than just that. However, looking at his children through the eyes of the selfish gene is actually a very productive way. It's not the only way, but it's a very productive way. And so that's what I'm trying to do here, is to look at the world through the eyes of technology as if it was a selfish agent. Not saying it's the only way to look at it, but just one way. And when you do that, when you look at it through the eye of technology, it's very clear that it is selfish. That there is a way of looking at its own agenda that may not be the only way to look at it, but just one way. And I think that that if you look at the world through the eyes of technology, you'll see some of the things that I'm talking about over the long term, I think that's the view that I'm trying to promote here is looking at it through the eyes of technology.
And so from that perspective, those additional choices, as we've mentioned, aren't going to, while they'll bring new problems, they'll bring benefits that will outweigh those problems. Is that what you're thinking?
Well, so what happens with looking at through the eyes of technology is that I think that most of the solutions to the problems of technology are going to be more technology.
Right.
The natural tendency is to say if technology is causing the problem, then we want to reduce the amount of technology. The technological viewpoint says that the solution to any technogenic problem, any problem caused by technology, the solution should be less technology. And I'm saying, well, from the technology's viewpoint, any problem caused by technogenic problem, the solution is going to be more technology. And the analogy that I use is you have technology is kind of like an idea that you make concrete, you make real. And then if I was to sit here and announce an idea that was really bad, a bad idea that maybe caused harm or just was untrue or was actually going to be diminishing problems in the opportunities in the world. If I had a bad idea, you would not counsel me to stop thinking, and we don't counsel other people to stop thinking if they have a bad idea. The proper response to a bad idea is to have a better idea. In the same way, the proper response to bad technology or technology that might cause harm is not less technology, but better technology. And so I think we can actually find technologies to help us with the fact that one of the problems caused by technology is too many choices, too many opportunities. And so the natural response is to say, well, we need less technology so we have less choices. But I'm saying, no, that's like, it's like asking you to think less.
Right.
No, what we want is we want to have technological solutions to the fact that there's too many technological choices. And that sounds crazy, but an example would be the default. Every large system, including your computer systems, have defaults. And what are defaults? Defaults are basically choices that in some ways hide other choices. And so in your computer, there's all kinds of choices that you have that are hidden from you because a default has been set. And that later on, when you know more or more advanced, or you have some inclination, you can go in and change the default. So it's a choice that's being hidden from you technologically to expand when you're ready to deal with the choice. That's just one kind of tiny, primitive, crude technology that's helping us deal with the many choices we have by sort of hiding them until we need them. And so we can kind of, I think in the future, we'll invent even more ways in which we can use technology to deal with the fact that we seem to have too many choices.
I love that idea of comparing it to ideas and comparing it to thinking, because while it seems there are many folks who are going to make the argument that we have too much technology, or even some that we have too many choices, hardly anyone is going to suggest that there's too much thinking going on, or that we have too many ideas. I think that's
right.
That's a great way of
right.
framing that.
And that is, I mean, we really have to understand the fact that science and technology is a way of thinking. It is a type of thought. That the kind of you know, evolution is really a kind of learning, seen from in an abstract way. The distinction between how a brain learns and how life learns and evolves is really immaterial, and so the technium and technology and science really is a way of knowing. It really is a way of thinking, and while there's a metaphorical equivalence between technology and thinking, it really is much closer than we realize.
Now, you made a reference to things being sort of built into the universe, and I want to come back to that. That was a question I had in the original The World Transformed, Part 1, a couple of years ago, when I asked one of our futurist guests whether all of history from the Big Bang until this moment had sort of been leading up to, at that time, I said the invention of the iPhone. I might have said iPad if I were referring to questions today. But I think you say something similar about how, is it the BlackBerry that's embedded in the proto Big Bang universe?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how that works.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of inevitabilities in this evolutionary thrust. And we know that from our experiments in trying to understand evolution, that we actually can do the great Stephen Gould thought experiment of rewinding the tape of life, so to speak, go back to the initial conditions and rerun it again to see if the things in biology would happen again. And we have lots of evidence on Earth in convergent evolution around different continents that were separated, where we see the same kinds of larger forms reoccurring. We see it in bacterial experiments where they can take clones, identical clones, and identical containers and run them for 50,000 generations and have them evolve basically the same kind of genes, which by the old orthodoxy was never supposed to happen because things were supposed to be random and contingent. But it turns out that these very large systems are bound in many ways by the nature of the chemistry and physics and energy to kind of return to similar things because they can't get out of the basin of attraction, which is sort of the theoretical terms for this. And so that means that, you know, the hypothesis would be that if you went to other galaxies and other planets, that you're going to see some very similar things. And, you know, that the constraints for where lifelike things can happen are narrow. We may not have thought of them all. We're constantly surprised on our own planet to discover life in places that we didn't think life could be, like inside the middle of rocks, you know, miles and miles down inside the
right.
Earth or in space. So we are surprised. However, what's interesting about that is when we do see that, we again see that the molecules and the systems that are allow this are actually very narrow in their own constraints. And so while there may be, you know, I don't know, multiple ways to make life or even base pairs that you can make a lifelike system, which would generate infinite variety, there aren't that many in chemistry that are going to allow you to self-evolve, to get there self-organized. So self-organization of this thing is a very small space. So there is a sense in which, while life is inevitable around the universe, it's also very rare in terms of the systems that will allow it to happen. So we think, those who take that kind of view, that DNA is probably the most remarkable molecule in the universe. There may not be that many molecules that can both self-organize, I mean, they can generate that kind of diversity and self-organize at the same time.
Right.
And so what this idea is that there is a progression of forms that one goes through. But what I don't want to indicate is that there is in some ways a convergence towards an endpoint. There is these forms are directions, not destinies. That it's not as if that you're going to have to find, you know, mammals on another planet. It's the idea that with the right conditions, you might find things like a tubular gut in an animal, or bilateral symmetry. That these things would occur again and again because the physics of a body would suggest it. And it's not that it's everyone's going to have it, just that's going to be a recurring theme wherever you would find these kinds of self-organized systems.
The Evo-Devo School of Evolutionary Biology talks about these developmental optima that evolution works towards. Is that the same idea?
It's exactly the same thing. It's to say that lots of the things that we see in evolution, lots of the things that we see in life are due to developmental progressions rather than evolutionary progressions. And so let me put it this way. It's just like anybody who's listening to me today, right now, has encountered certain inevitable progressions in their life, going from a fertilized egg cell to a blastula to embryo and a fetus and toddler and so forth. And in a certain sense, all those things were inevitable. That they're constrained by the very nature of life. And so you progress through those things, and eventually, you know, you become a teenager, which was inevitable if you lived that long. However, what kind of teenager you were, the species, the variety, the temperament, those are all things that were not ordained. Those are things in which there's freedom, there's you know, diversity, and so both of the things are going on whenever we have these very large scale systems. Some technological developments are inevitable, but even the ones that are, the actual expression of those technological developments are not inevitable. So that's the nature of life.
So let me ask I want to ask a question, and I want to phrase it two ways. With that in mind, one way of phrasing it, was humanity inevitable? And two, another way of phrasing it is, there's this, recently I read about this moment in prehistoric history when there were just a few of us left. Things had kind of gone bad, and there were maybe only 10,000 humans left. And it's like, mm-hmm. You look back at it and you go, hey, we could have been wiped out. That could have been the end right there before anything ever actually happened. So the other way of asking that question is, would that have been the end of the story, or was humanity something that would have popped back up somewhere else some other way?
I think humanity defined as sentient self-conscious beings was inevitable. I don't think it was inevitable that it had to be primates or that it had to be this particular primates. I think that had those 10,000, you know, humanoids been eradicated, that, you know, later on through the gorillas or somewhere else, minds, self-reflective conscious minds would have come up. In fact, I think that if we allow gorillas to live long enough, they too may eventually become conscious and human-like in that definition. And then there are others who look at cephalopods and the amazing minds that the invertebrate, you know, the octopus have, mm-hmm. and the degree in which they're conscious to, you know, suggest that, yeah, had the primates or even the mammals not occurred, you might have had cephalopodian type of consciousness. And of course then we have the whales and the dolphins who themselves may be on the way. And so humanity, if we define humanity as kind of bipedal, you know, naked primates, I don't think that was inevitable at all. I think humanity as sentience, self-conscious sentience that was able to actually remake themselves, self-create, a self-created being, yes, that will happen again and again as well as happening once.
Okay, so let me continue with this same idea, and I'm going to combine two ideas I got from your book, perhaps unfairly,
right.
And you can tell me if it's fair or not, okay?
Sure.
So as you've mentioned, in the book you make this argument that humanity is our first technology, and you also argue that technologies, they can't be banned and that they can't go extinct.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that humanity can't go extinct?
Yes, I think what I suggest is that we have no evidence of a technology that's ever gone extinct. They may become obsolete in the sense that they are not used very much, but the difference between technology and biology is that biology, specimens and species go extinct, whereas in technology, just the artifacts do, and the species, the idea of it generally does not. And so I think it's very, very unlikely for humans to go extinct. I think it would be very, 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 very difficult to do. Maybe we're on the verge of extinction with, 10,000 humans. But I think that as long as there are like two or three or something, they're going to bounce back. And particularly if they're surrounded by the evidence of what we've built already. I think as long as the artifactual world exists, there's so much information that we have coded into the things that we've made and are around us, the cities. They would have to crumble an awful lot before the information that's in them is lost. And I think that it's possible that you could have great setbacks. But the whole thing of self-organization is there's a ratcheting effect. It kind of goes forward. And part of what civilization actually is, it's a device to prevent us from backsliding. It's a device that you keep adding layers and layers of more complexity so that it gets harder and harder to kill. And I think civilization actually, as a whole, is very difficult to get rid of now. I mean, I don't think anybody that I've ever heard has come up with a plausible explanation of how civilization could be extinct or eliminated worldwide forever. It would be very, very, very hard to do that.
And it's even going back to the earlier point, even if you could somehow extinct all of humanity, if the whole species were to be to be wiped out, as long as there was some living things left on the earth, the developmental optima would still be in place for that broader definition that you gave, the sentient intelligent beings, and it would reorganize. Or if there were a few humans left and they'd fallen into a less civilized state, that they would immediately begin reorganizing towards true civilization.
Right. I mean, if there was some weird being from the universe that just killed every single human alive today, then suddenly, the pressure would be on the gorillas and the dolphins to keep going. And, it may take a couple more million years before that would happen. But what's really interesting is, I don't know. I haven't actually looked for the evidence. I've often wondered whether or not there's any evidence about whether gorillas are increasing their IQ over time, even now. I mean, it's very possible that they could be, and we were not even aware of it. So, I think that if you were to eliminate all Homo sapiens from the planet, it would continue. But I actually think that eliminating every Homo sapiens from the planet is an incredibly difficult job. I feel the same way about turning off the internet. I don't think we could turn off the internet now if we wanted to. If we tried to, I think it'd be almost impossible to turn it off. These things, it's just like we can't eliminate life on Earth. I mean, people think, well, the asteroid hit. It's not going to eliminate life on Earth. These systems are made for billions of years to not go away easily. And I think that's where we're at.
It seems that maybe their resilience hasn't been properly respected, that people aren't
exactly
seeing how durable some of these things are.
Right.
Okay, well, now as we come to the close of the book, you make a very compelling argument that we've talked a little bit about how technology continually opens up new choices and new possibilities for people. And you give these wonderful hypothetical scenarios of Mozart being born into a world where there was no piano invented, or Charlie Chaplin has to live out his life in a world where film never showed up. And for anybody who believes, as I do, that we're still in the very early days when it comes to inventing things, this seems to say something really profound about the tremendous potential that exists for people to express themselves and to live their lives with meaning and purpose in like completely new and unexpected, and I would say even unimaginable ways. And it also makes me kind of sad for all these would-be virtuosos who are around us all the time and who will never get the opportunity to do something beautiful and meaningful in their perfect medium. So I guess the final question is, if technology is, as you describe, an infinite game, is the future of humanity an infinite opening up of possibilities for happiness and for fulfillment and for meaning in our lives? Is it that bright and cheery of a picture?
Yes, it is. Of course, it's not without problems. It's not a utopia. It says that the reason why there is progress and today is a little better than yesterday is that today people on average have a little better chance of finding and expressing those unique set of skills and talents that they have. So nobody in their right mind wants to live 1,000 years ago. Because even as you were saying earlier, even a king at that time had a tenth of the opportunities and possibilities that a fast food worker today has. So nobody wants to go backwards because there's less opportunity and choices for the average person, and that means to me that there's a moral dimension to technology, that there's a moral charge to a positive, overall positive charge that's slightly in the positive, that's moving us forward, and that we also have a moral obligation to increase the amount of option gaining technologies in the world to benefit those children today and the unborn to come. And that we do that because we have been blessed by people in the past who have invented the technology of the microphone and technology of radio or of printing and books, and that we're now benefiting from. And so that we have, in some senses, an obligation to keep inventing possibilities with the hope that every person in the world has a little better chance of finding those technologies that will help them express and share their genius. And I think that's a good thing to be working towards.
Absolutely. Well, it's a wonderful vision. And Kevin Kelly, I thank you so much for taking the time to share it with us on The World Transformed.
It's been my pleasure and privilege being here. Thank you for your interest in my work.
And with those parting thoughts from Kevin Kelly, that's going to do it for this edition of The World Transformed 2 and for the series as a whole.
We want to say a special thank you to the partner organizations that have helped make this show and this series possible. The SINS Foundation, the Foresight Institute, Humanity Plus, and the Singularity University. And now here's a special message from the SINS Foundation.
We are very pleased and honored to list the SINS Foundation as one of the partners presenting The World Transformed with us to you. And I'm talking with our good friend and World Transformed guest, Dr. Aubrey de Grey, who is the Chief Science Officer of the SINS Foundation. Hello, Aubrey.
Hello.
Well, we're pleased to have you with us. Could you tell us a little bit about the SINS Foundation? What is it? How did the organization come to be?
Sure. SINS Foundation is a U.S. registered public charity, a 501c3. And our mission is to develop regenerative medicine solutions for the problems of aging. In other words, essentially to treat aging as a medical condition that can be not merely slowed down, but actually reversed, giving true rejuvenation throughout the whole body, not just how you look, but also how you feel and how you function. We came into existence a couple of years ago now as a sort of offshoot from the Methuselah Foundation, which I co-founded back in 2002, and which had the same mission. And the Methuselah Foundation and SINS Foundation currently act very much in tandem with pretty much identical missions, but going about them in complementary ways. The Methuselah Foundation focuses very strongly on prizes, the incentives to get this work to happen, and Sense Foundation focuses on directly funding particular research projects.
Very good. So why would, in particular, listeners of Fast Forward Radio or the World Transformed, why would they be interested in this organization?
Well, when people ask me why would such and such a group be interested in this work, my usual reaction is really, you know, why would anyone not be interested? Because,
Right. Of
course, aging is really rather bad for you. It kills an awful lot of people. Aging is responsible for about two-thirds of all deaths worldwide and about 90% of all deaths in the industrialized world, because it is simply the set of lifelong processes of accumulating molecular and cellular damage that eventually give rise to all of the diseases and disabilities that we see late in life, such as cancer and cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's and type 2 diabetes and osteoarthritis and such like. So the idea here is not simply to treat those diseases in the way that we spend such an enormous amount of money today trying unsuccessfully to do, but actually to prevent those diseases from occurring in the first place, however old one lives to, simply by addressing their, as I say, accumulating precursors.
Is it fair to say that those who have read your book, Ending Aging, have a pretty good background on what it is that the Sense Foundation is working on, at least at a high level?
I would say so, yes. I think that even though it's now 3 or 4 years old, Ending Aging is still a really pretty comprehensive description of not only the types of problems that we need to address if we want to really bring aging under medical control, but also the types of approach that exist to solve it. That's especially true if one gets the paperback edition, because that came out a year after the hardback edition, and in that 1 year, there was so much progress in most of the areas of that we cover in Sense that we had to write an entire new chapter just to document them. If you've already got the hardback edition, then that new chapter, the afterword, is actually available for free as a PDF on the Sense Foundation website, sense.org. So that's a way to get it as well. But yes, it really shows how rapid progress is in this area.
Everyone should check that out if they're interested in seeing the progress made. And I would say for our listeners and readers of The Speculist, we all express great interest in this issue and talk about the need to do something about aging and do something about extending life. Well, here's an opportunity to actually be involved in an organization that's doing something about that. And speaking of which, how can people get involved with the Sense Foundation?
Yeah, certainly sense.org is the place to start, our website. We have, of course, lots of information there about what we're doing and about what other people are doing, in fact, in related areas that are relevant to our eventual success. But, of course, we also have plenty of information there for the general public about how to get involved and what sort of things to do. You know, if you're a biologist, what sort of research to get involved in. If you're a journalist, how to get in touch with us to do an interview, for example, or to get me to give a lecture, or, of course, how to get involved in advocacy of all sorts. There's a quite extensive frequently asked questions page that talks about all this. And of course, finally and most importantly, you can always write to us. There is a feedback form on the website in which you can get a personalized response to exactly that sort of query.
All right. Terrific opportunities for folks who want to get involved, and I urge everyone to check it out. Aubrey, thank you for talking about this with us today.
My pleasure.
All right. So once again, go to sense.org, or you can track this organization down through our links at worldtransformed.com. Thanks once again to the 30 brilliant and fascinating people who took the time to talk to us throughout the World Transformed 2, and thanks to all of you for joining us. So with a special shout-out to Sally and all the participants in the chat room. Also, once again, many thanks to Jean-Sebastien Bimius for providing our theme music. Well, it's been a wonderful 10 weeks, and it went by much too fast. As Ben Gertzel observed a few weeks ago, we can look forward to watching the world as it continues to transform. And to that end, I'm pleased to announce that next week, Fast Forward Radio resumes its normal broadcast format. Stephen, we're going back to the regular show.
All right.
The journey continues. We hope you'll join us. And until next time, live to see it.